This is a special Humans Invent Cycling podcast recorded last week live in front of an audience at Cadence Performance in South London. The first part is available to download right now, and this is the second part, a Q&A with the audience. Okay, this is part two of our Humans Invent Cycling podcast live, an event in association with Cycling Anthology. And this is the questions round with the exciting prize of two tickets for Revolution, which I know Daniel has got his eye on.
They were my tickets.
They were your tickets. So, hands up please for any questions.
I was wondering about your opinion, if there's any other riders out there that really do thrive in the cold, topless than us, or vice versa, really, really thriving in the heat, and how much that affects riders' ability to perform on the day.
So the question is about, quote, Tom Boonen said he didn't like the wet and cold of Het Nieuwsblad, and how much does weather affect different riders, which riders perform well in the heat and which perform well in the cold. It's sometimes quite surprising that riders from cold countries perform well in the heat and vice versa. I'm trying to think of an example because one did occur to me, but there was one. No, just the other day I was reading about this very scenario, and it's gone. But Daniel can fill in for a moment while I think of it.
You do get riders. This is a bad example because he's just retired, but Sandy Cazar was someone who needed it to be absolutely red hot and just was a rider who could have done well in the Ardennes Classics and stuff, but never really did just because it was often cold and didn't really like it. But Aston Hagen, he tends to like the cold. It used to be related to how effective amphetamines were in certain types of weather. Going back a few decades, I mean, I don't know how true it is, but that's always been said about Charlie Gall. Charlie Gall was famous for these incredible epic rides. Not all of his epic rides were in cold, wet conditions, but a lot were. And it's often been speculated that was because he took an awful lot of amphetamines.
I remember the cyclist in question was Lance Armstrong. I don't know how I forgot him, but
did he win the 1998 Tour of Luxembourg? Was it that guy? That's his last, right?
He was in last significant win. Victory. he hated the heat, didn't he? And yet he was from Texas, which is hot, and he performed well in the cold and the rain.
Was that was based on? I always think that was based on one day, that when he lost the time trial to Ulrich.
Also,
if you think
about 99, Sestria, or was Sestria, was that bad? That was bad weather, wasn't it? 99.
Yeah, he won the world title in Oslo in the cold
case.
In the rain.
Case proven.
He also won. He also went endless stages in blazing heat.
He was really good, wasn't he? Ellis, are you a hot weather rider or a cold weather rider?
Well, you know, you have to take what you get, don't you, really? But yeah, I don't know. I don't mind really about being out in the rain.
The question wasn't about us.
I know. Well, actually, you just said,
turned it on its head.
I know. I don't know. I guess a lot of racers, you know, there is that old thing, isn't there, about sort of if you, you know, just get on with it or train in the rain. You know, the whole idea that most people hate it. So if you can become a sort of specialist in cold, wet weather, you know, you could have a better chance of winning, because a lot of people ride just quite rightly, like us, you know, you sort of switch off, don't you, and just try and get through.
Yeah, I think Sean Kelly famously, the quote that I don't think he ever said, but about, you know, getting up in the morning and if it was raining, he'd be rubbing his hands together. He said, you know, that wasn't really the case. But what it did mean for him was that it automatically cut down the number of people who could potentially win the race. Already, you know, there might only be 20 people who could win a race like Paris-Roubaix or the Tour of Lombardy. And then if it was sheeting down with rain, you know, that cuts that number down to maybe five. And then there's going to be crashes and bad luck. And so he's seized on the poor weather as an opportunity. And, of course, he really didn't like the heat. When he suffered the most in the Tour de France was on the roasting hot days. He lost the yellow jersey the only time he had it in the Pyrenees on a really hot day. He suffered terribly with the heat that day.
I think there was a question at the back there as well. Yeah. Do we think Alejandro Valverde has shown how to beat Sky in a stage race, or was Richie Porte not strong enough to do the job? You're talking about the Tour of Andalusia. No, yeah, Andalusia.
Yeah, Ruta del Sol.
Yeah, Ruta del Sol, Andalusia, yeah, yeah. I was getting confused. There were so many races going on at that time. I think Valverde was in terrific form there, wasn't he? And maybe Porte wasn't in such good form. I mean, Sky rode as though, you know, they were riding for Porte to win. Clearly, almost you wonder if it's a sort of rehearsal in a way. Geraint Thomas looked very strong on the uphill finish that Valverde won, stage one after the time trial. But I think Valverde looked to be in great form and really a level above everybody else. And he's you know, he's a threat, but he'll have to maintain that all the way to July. I think that, you know, last year at the Tour we saw teams take it to Sky and show how to beat Sky. I mean, we saw lots of really great team performances at the Tour last year. Daniel mentioned the Sage to Albi, where Cannondale had a brilliant plan that they executed very well for Peter Sagan. But on other days, you know, in the Pyrenees, we saw Movistar isolate Chris Froome, didn't take advantage of that as they could have done. And then on the crosswind stage, we saw Omega Pharma, Saxo, Belkin all sort of team up and again put some distance between them and Froome. And I don't think you could say that Froome won the Tour thanks to his team last year. You could almost say that he won the Tour despite his team, perhaps. So, you know, it's not perhaps the same as 2012 when Wiggins' victory in the Tour was very much a team performance, I think.
I do think Movistar look like the team most likely, though, really, if anyone's going to topple Sky. I sort of get the impression that they're sort of, they've followed the Sky model, really, if you like. Valverde, though, I mean, they're sort of putting everyone behind him for the Tour, supposedly, and yeah, supposedly not taking Nairo Quintana this year, which seems crazy, really. But I mean, Valverde obviously was unlucky in last year's Tour. He punctured at that very inopportune time during the I think it was the 13th stage in the wind with all those echelons. So, I mean, I think if Movistar do take Quintana, I mean, you want to have a double-pronged attack, really, I think, to take on the Sky. You'd be crazy to put all your eggs into the one Valverde basket, I think.
The one ageing basket. I mean, can we see Valverde really winning the Tour?
No, probably not. But I think it's always, we get lulled into kind of looking at races like the Ruta del Sol and even sort of Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico, because we hope they're going to give us some clues as to who's going to be going well later in the year. But I think, you know, it sounds obvious, but the proof of the pudding is when the big guns go up against each other in the big races. And, you know, Richie Porte's season isn't going to be defined by whether or not he won the Ruta del Sol. It's going to be defined by whether he gets on the podium at the Giro. So, you know, it's a nice win for Valverde, who, again, the curve of his season is going to have a sort of mini peak for the Ardennes Classics, because he always does. So, you know, he's probably testing himself out, looking sort of 4 or 5 weeks at those races. That's, well, particularly Liège-Bastogne-Liège, isn't it? Not necessarily Flèche-Wallonne.
Any other questions? Yeah, at the back, right at the back there. Are you asking Bradley Wiggins, given that he wants to ride in Rio in 2016, will that be to the detriment of his final, potentially his final road season? I think it would have to be, wouldn't it? He would have to be building his year around competing on the track in Rio. Unless he goes to Rio and rides the time trial, perhaps. I mean, he has hinted at wanting to come back and ride the team pursuit, but perhaps the time trial would be an option. He's riding the time trial at the Commonwealth Games this year, which is quite interesting. I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, people do tend to think that he's going to retire after 2016. I mean, his contract with Team Sky runs out at the end of this year. There is another offer there from Sky to extend that, presumably to 2016. 2016 could be the last year of Team Sky as well. That's when they're contracted up to. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. He's signed with this new agency, Simon Fuller's agency, who look after the real A-list sports stars, you know, Beckham, Lewis Hamilton, Andy Murray. And speaking to his agent in Mallorca, his new agent, they've got real long-term plans for him, and they see him as still being top sportsman who's winning big races. It's going to be interesting to see how things pan out for him this year, next year, and 2016.
I just wanted to add that, yeah, he talked about riding the team pursuit in Rio, but someone, I can't remember who it was, maybe one of you remembers, but someone last year had said, "Oh no, he's got no chance. You know, he's never going to get in because these guys are just." Especially, I was going to say, now maybe, you know, they're going to think again that they could well take him on. But I mean, it's a long way off yet, isn't it? There's a lot of things could happen yet, and these team pursuiters could obviously improve a lot yet. But I think it was more that they were talking about, you know, that the current track guys are such specialists that even somebody like Wiggins would actually struggle to get enough specific training in to even be as good as them.
Yeah, I think on the team pursuit thing, Wiggins could certainly slot back in, but whether he could slot back into a team that's going to need to do, what, 350, whatever it's going to be, it's going to have to be low, isn't it? Whether he could slot back into a team that is so kind of front-loaded with Stephen Burke and Ed Clancy as the kind of sprinters, really. They're kilo riders, really, aren't they, that kick off and take the pursuit up to that phenomenal speed at the start, which is the crucial first phase. And Wiggins, as a rider, has much more of a kind of a diesel engine, obviously a very, very good one. His problem is actually getting onto the wheels in those first two laps, really. And he would have to do a lot of work to return to that kind of sprint-based in track endurance athlete compared to what he's been doing the last few years.
I always remember Tim Kerrison saying that he was surprised when he started working with Bradley Wiggins. He assumed that because he had such a track background that he would be not a sprint athlete, but he'd have a great top end, you know, ability to go into the red and you know, have that acceleration that a trackie often has, even an endurance rider. And he said he didn't. He was surprised that his profile's physiology is more of a road endurance rider. And you know, as he gets older, I guess that top end speed will perhaps prove more elusive. So it could be quite tough for him. Daniel, you're very quiet. Any other questions? Yeah.
So this is off the back of a debate I've had with my friends about would Het Nieuwsblad be different had they had earpieces? So the question is, how do you think a lack of earpieces, or indeed earpieces, changed the way racers play up tactically, especially in one-day races where things are a fair bit less formulaic than they are in stage races?
Could be an early front-runner there for the competition. Don't want to prejudge it at all, but that's a very good question. You could argue that perhaps it did. I mean, it was a fascinating race from a strategy point of view. Omega Pharma had several hands to play, and Sky then had, you know, the group chasing Stannard and Van Avermaet. You thought if they came back together, Sky's chances would increase. Now, did Stannard perhaps not know that Bosenhagen was there? I don't know.
I mean, if I was the DS, I would have Stannard sit on GBA's wheel,
yeah,
and let that group come together with EBH, and then get Stannard basically to hold it all together and let EBH sprint for the win.
Yeah.
Because 90 times out of 20, you'd think Stannard would lose that sprint against Greg, and it's just because Greg, he said himself he thought he'd won it already before he got there, and he made about three or four mistakes. I mean, he even crossed him on the finish.
Yeah, our questioner is imagining himself in the team car as a DS, and in his fantasy cycling, you would have had Stannard sit on Greg Van Avermaet's wheel.
Yeah.
And I think, watching it, that's probably what I would have done as well.
I mean, just as a general point, I don't know if anyone here has sat in team cars with them in races. I think you'd be surprised, even when they did have radios, how little communication, how rudimentary the communication always was. Partly because there's usually a big delay between something happening. You know, what happens is a race radio calls out numbers of, you know, for instance, if there's a break. And often it takes quite a while for that information to come back. by the time the information's come back, often it's almost redundant a lot of the time, especially in the first hour or two of races when there are breaks going constantly. And often, you know, when I've sat in team cars, often all the team managers really says, make sure we're in a break. They're not saying 112, that's so-and-so, go after him, go. You know, I haven't been in... I mean, I've been in some team cars with some directors who they barely even knew what country they were in. I can think of one in particular at the Tour de l'Avenir. But, they do vary, but I think there are some directors who were a lot more communicative than others. But I think a lot of it is kind of, you've all probably seen the videos of Marc Madiot for the Française des Jeux just screaming at people. And in terms of like the intricacies of it tactically, I think an awful lot always came from the riders.
I think that is a good point. The idea that the riders are, that they're like remote control cars or something being controlled by the DS and the team car is certainly incorrect. Ultimately, it does come down to the riders. I remember being in the Tour of Britain team car in 2010 in the Team Sky team car in the Tour of Britain when Team Sky were in a perfect position with Geraint Thomas, Bradley Wiggins and Greg Henderson all in the lead group. And, you know, Stephen de Jong, who was driving the team car, had a pretty good idea of what they should do. And he did try to communicate that to the riders, but ultimately it was down to them what they did. And there's only so much you can actually control in that situation.
Yeah, I was just going to say, one of the most memorable days I've had covering cycling was the 2009 Gent-Wevelgem, where I managed to blag my way into the HTC car with Brian Holm, who was driving, and Eric Zabel, who was cracking jokes most of the day, it seemed, and a mechanic sat in the back, and me wedged in between the wheels, and pretty uncomfortable car sick inducing day. But it was a terrible day weather-wise, and as Daniel said, you know, basically the idea I had, this was at the peak of this debate about whether the riders should have earpiece radios and whether the managers should be able to call the shots in races. And I wanted to see what actually happened in a big race like that, whether it was, you know, whether the influence from the team car was too great. And I have to say, you know, it was minimal. I mean, the practical information they can give across is limited to just, as you say, Daniel, make sure you're in the break. You know, we've got a right-hand turn coming up, winds from the left, so, you know, a warning about crosswinds, but really not detailed tactical decision making. And in that race in particular, it split to pieces in a terrible weather at the start in the first 30 or 40k, and after that it was just a case of, you know, the bunch is all split everywhere, the cars are everywhere, there's carnage all over the place, nobody knows who's where. Whenever a rider tried to talk to the team car, it's just a hiss of feedback.
I mean, that was another thing I was going to say that bears pointing out. The radios are absolute rubbish. They're just junk. They never, ever seem to... You know, the number of times I've been in a team car, it's like an episode of Only Fools and Horses, just every single time. They're just, what, it's not working again? No, it's not working again. I don't know if they've improved in the last... I mean, it's a while. It's probably a year or two since I've been in a team car, but it always mystified me, especially with, you know, Sky gets so much attention for the amount of money they plough into technology and stuff, that someone has not come up with a device that just gives you, you know, perfect sound.
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? Because it's playing out over such a range, and they're restricted to what the aerial can do. But I do remember Zabel. I was talking to them about when the race calmed down a bit, and I was asking about you know, the impact of race radios. And Zabel was talking about an edition of the Tour of Mallorca, which, if you're not familiar with it, it's basically 5 one-day races that kind of all build up into a stage race, but the riders don't have to ride every day. So unlike in the Tour de France, where you have to ride every day to be in the results, in the Tour of Mallorca, which is an early season race, you could ride on day 1, 3 and 5 if you wish, or you could miss out the hilly day and only do the flat one. And HTC were in this race, and Zabel was doing the team manager bit, and he was like, OK, guys, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Right, OK, guys, everything for Seabee, which is Marcel Seberg, who was their sprinter, or sort of a big sort of diesel engine. OK, everyone, get behind Seabee. It's all for Seabee now in the last 10K or more. And, you know, he's giving all of his directions. And it wasn't until they crossed the line that they realised Seberg hadn't actually started the stage and was back at the hotel.
Actually, though, having said all of that, all valid points, Saturday, Het Nieuwsblad was perhaps a day when, had there been radios, they would have told Saturday, because it was for quite a long time, there was certainly time and there were good time checks and there were straight roads and all the rest of it, they probably would have, again, you can be too clever, and they probably would have said to Stannard, sit on Van Avermaet, and, you know, but Bosenhagen's coming up behind you, and you've got two out of five rather than one in two. And, you know, that might have been the wrong decision. So, you know, I think a lot of time as well, I remember being in the team car once with Scott Sunderland, and he didn't give the riders an awful lot of information in the last hour because he trusted their racing instincts. He didn't tell them when sprinters had been dropped because it didn't. He said that doesn't affect the way that they should be racing. It doesn't matter whether a rival sprinter is there or not. So I think you can try to be too smart with it as well, and I think often, I mean, Stannard probably knew on Saturday that he had the legs to win it.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
So the question was about legal products, like Xenon, the gas that apparently was used by some of the Russian athletes at the Winter Olympics, and Tramadol, a painkiller. This is a new sort of area of anti-doping where we're kind of moved beyond the WADA list and we're now searching out products that aren't on the list but may be unethical. And maybe on the list in the future. You know, the list changes a lot. Caffeine is not on the list at the moment, so riders use caffeine. And it's, you know, there was obviously a huge spotlight on Team Sky at the Tour de France last year, and we were asking them all the questions we could think of, you know, about TUEs, therapeutic use exemptions. Geraint Thomas struggled most of the race with a broken pelvis, so I was asking him what painkillers he was using. He said he was just using ibuprofen. He was taking ibuprofen. The doctor with Team Sky, Alan Barr, said that, you know, they didn't have any TUEs in the team, because we have suspected in the past that TUEs have been abused as well. But this is a whole new area, and it's fascinating. There are sort of serious ethical questions about a lot of it, and, you know, oxygen tents as well. It's not perhaps a natural way of preparing, but it's legal now. Not legal in all countries, is that right? But it's not; they're not on the WADA list. So, it just gets more and more confusing, doesn't it?
I definitely think that things like that are being done. You know, painkillers, etc. The limits are being pushed in that way. But I think the riders now are getting a lot of feedback about the benefits that they're getting from equipment, and I think it's grown exponentially. And the important thing is the feedback. I mean, I mentioned earlier Sebastian Weber, who's the coach at Canada. We were talking about the sort of amateur scientists who are estimating wattages on climbs and saying so-and-so must be doping because he's doing 450 watts. Well, Sebastian said that, just to give one example, I think last year the team he was working for changed tyre manufacturer. And the riders were complaining that the new tyres seemed grabby. They just didn't seem to roll very well. Anyway, they went and did tests in a velodrome, and the difference between the old tyres and the new tyres was 17 watts on average. And, you know, so that's when people are making these calculations, they're saying that, okay, over 410 watts, or that's definitely doping. Well, if a tyre can make 17 watts, and that's one piece of equipment, it might be 20 pieces of equipment like that. And I think the riders are becoming more and more aware of that. And I think they've got more and more people saying to them, look, if you wear this skin suit, that's 10 watts. If you use these tyres, that's another 20 watts. So I think, you know, if you're getting all that information about things that you can do, then I think there's less of an incentive to look for illegal things.
And I spoke to Chris Borman about this recently and about aerodynamics, and he just thinks it's absolutely everything. He can't believe the number of riders who won't take this on board. This is him particularly working with British Cycling. And he just can't believe how other countries haven't kind of, the bigger nations have to an extent, but a lot of the sort of more traditional pro teams haven't really taken any of their riders to wind tunnels or anything. And it's out there now, all this stuff, aero road helmets, skin suits in road races. But he says a lot of it comes down to just tradition and fashion, and a lot of riders just refuse to sort of get on board. But yeah, in terms of what the riders think, I mean, I think they're quite pleased not to be asked about doping as much that they're as much as before. That, you know, there is this, you know, aerodynamics question and diet and training and yeah, I mean, riders are, they're a lot skinnier than they've ever been, and I think there have been problems in women's cycling, especially with eating disorders in recent years.
Can I put the ethical question to you, Lionel? You're an elite athlete. You're a tour contender.
Thank you very much.
You're aware of a product that's out there that's not on the banned list. And it's legal.
It's not cassoulet.
That'd be wonderful if that was a performance enhancer. Yeah. But you know, do you use it? I mean, why wouldn't you use it in a sense?
What an ethical it's a very good point. I mean, what would I do? Well, I personally wouldn't. But
anyone got any Zen on?
But I think back to the point you made about particularly tramadol, which came up during last year's tour as a heavy duty painkiller. Now the reports of the xenon gas that the Winter Olympics athletes, particularly Russians, were using allegedly. Obviously, these are substances that already there is a consensus among some of the teams. Garmin particularly have mentioned, you know, that they think tramadol should be added to WADA's list. Everything I've read about xenon gas, and I don't know a huge amount about it, but everything I've read indicates that it will be banned because, you know, it's an artificial performance enhancer that goes beyond you know, where the line is currently drawn. And you mentioned about eating disorders and weight being such a crucial part now of you know, in the EPO era, there wasn't the same imperative to be as skinny and as light and maximise your power to weight ratio. And so weight loss drugs, there have been a lot of rumours flying around and a lot of accusations that certain riders are skinnier than perhaps they should be. The difficulty is, going back to the question, if my living depended on it and it was the difference between, you know, winning these races and making an awful lot of money and not doing so, the question is going to be weighing heavy on your mind if you're in any way tempted to cross that line. So the problem is that the substances are, again, and will always be, probably ahead of the authorities' ability to detect them. And so just because, you know, certain improvements have been made with regard to blood doping, blood boosting and EPO, doesn't mean that the fight is won at all.
So Lionel would do it. I remember talking to Dave Brailsford at the end of 2010 when he was searching for, you know, what they could do to be competitive with Team Sky. You know, he talked about the line, and I took that to mean the line between legality and illegality. And he said we will go up to the line. And he said any elite athlete, it's kind of responsibility to go as close to the line as possible. And I guess what a lot of people don't understand is professional sport. For most people, sport is a bit of fun. It's an escape, and there's a sort of a lot of trust that we place in athletes to honour that. It goes back to, I suppose, the Olympic ideals and fair play and sportsmanship and all the rest of it. But professional sport is really very, very different, and there is this disconnect, I think, between what fans think sport is and what it actually is to the people at that level. Any other questions? Yep.
Cycling unfortunately seems to be struggling in some of its traditional heartlands, particularly Italy, Spain to an extent as well. To what extent is that just the economic problems the countries are currently experiencing? Or to what extent is the kind of EPO, the hangover from that, the lack of sort of progression in terms of equipment, maybe other things that are sort of so focused on chemical enhancement? And how much is that down from both sides, both riders coming through and its sort of perception from fans in those countries, maybe what can they do to...
So it sounds like a question for Daniel. The question is how cycling is struggling in its heartlands of Belgium, Italy, Spain, France.
Yeah.
Well, it's struggling more than it is, say, in the UK, where it's very popular at the moment. And is that economic reasons, or is it a hangover from the doping?
How long have you got? It's very complex. But I think, well, the economic issue is huge. I mean, it's something I've written about actually in the Pantani piece for the anthology. It's also I think some of it is was avoidable self-harm, and some of it was almost unavoidable. It's just a social change in cycling and in like Italian society particularly. You know, cycling in Italy got very big with the kind of a working class and sort of agricultural sort of fan base in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And really, Italy lost a lot of its manufacturing. It lost a lot of its kind of working class, lost a lot of its sort of self-esteem, etc. And Italy as a kind of economy started, well, changing and collapsing, and it's kind of it's collapsed over the last few years. And, you know, it's lost that kind of middle class that I think the Italian the working class used to identify with cycling so much, because it was, they were seeing guys who were essentially doing the same thing that they were doing, going to the factory, clocking on, and they were seeing guys suffering on a bike and basically doing the same thing, but showing that you could achieve dreams and you could make people dream, you know, suffering physically, etc. And I think that the working class has been eroded in Italy, and the sort of new middle class just doesn't really identify with it. And just on a more sort of basic level, races are disappearing because town councils rightly are not think that it's frivolous expenditure. It is frivolous in the grand scheme of everything that's going wrong in those countries, so they won't contribute. There are no industrial giants that are investing in big teams, and you know, we talked about the how important things like aerodynamics and sort of technical support is. And if you've got a £5 million budget, it's very difficult to compete with a team with a £15 million budget. I mean, also just on the doping, it does worry me still that sometimes I think they've got the message, and then sometimes I think they don't. They haven't got it. But the other night at the Cannondale training camp, Ivan Basso was there, and I quite like him. I've known him quite well over the years, and I do think that there's a high chance that he now rides clean. But there was a team of juniors in the hotel where Cannondale was staying, and one day the director sportif of the junior team went and asked Basso whether he would do a talk for the riders. And he's kind of typical of him, because he is, you know, PR wise he's very good, and he's also quite a generous guy, quite an attentive guy. So he said yes, and I went and sat in on the talk that he did, and they talked for about an hour. So he gave this speech to the junior team, and doping wasn't mentioned once. No one would go anywhere near the subject, and I just thought how different that was to someone like, you know, David Miller, who perhaps too much, perhaps he's made it a bit of a selling point for himself, but he's also done a lot of good, David Miller. But that is central to what he thinks he has to give to cycling now, that he wants to give back. Whereas to Basso, it's obviously something that, you know, it still has to be skirted around, and stuff like that just worries me slightly, that they still haven't really taken on board how important that is and how much damage it did to them as well.
With Basso, do you think, is it a sense of shame or denial?
Denial, and he's not really surrounded by a culture which makes him feel any shame, because no one mentions it. He's still, you know, the classic example was a couple of years ago when Danilo De Luca was banned. He was serving a ban, and Italian state television got him on their Giro coverage to do punditry, you know, and no one mentioned the doping. They just said, oh, you know, you'll come back stronger than before, won't you, Danilo? And he's sort of not his best.
I mean, it's interesting the point you make about the working class. I wonder, you know, football in this country was a very working class sport, but it thrived through reinventing itself, repackaging itself as a middle class sport in the 90s. I wonder if that's just something cycling has failed to do in those countries. Interestingly, here it is a middle class sport.
Yeah, it has packaged itself. I mean, like a lot of things with cycling in this country, I think cycling in this country benefits from the fact that it had nothing to grow from, nothing to change from. I think it's almost easier to package yourself as a middle class sport from scratch than it is to repackage yourself, having been a working class sport too. And there is this big disconnect, like, The Italian young people just don't really identify with cyclists. Cyclists don't really resonate with them. You know, they're much more interested in Valentino Rossi and actually Basso said an interesting thing about, it's also the way the media sells it. Football in Italy is synonymous with every sports paper now dedicates a lot of space to women in bikinis and fast cars. And Basso was saying that he's got a son who's playing in the AC Milan youth team. So he's only 9 or 10, but anyway, he said, you know, whatever I do, I can't make my son disassociate these sort of symbols of success. Even for a 9-year-old, he said, my son is thinking football is rich, is in wealth and is cars. And he said that, you know, that's just the way it's packaged, and the cycling is just not packaged like that.
Any other questions? Yep, we've got one here. Now that Discovery Channel bought Eurosport, are we moving into an era of multi-million pound rights for races? Are we moving into a sort of new era of TV coverage for cycling, Lionel?
Well, given that the rights to all but the Tour de France are sold for in sort of global sports rights terms, peanuts. I don't know whether suddenly, because a company has come in and bought Eurosport, that it's going to suddenly increase the amount of revenue that comes into the sport. I would have thought Discovery Channel are identifying it as something they can pick up cheaply and perhaps develop. And you know, certainly if you watch the coverage of the races, I mean, we all watched Het Nieuwsblad on Saturday on... Well, Richard bought a subscription to cycling.tv. I watched on an illegal internet feed one of the biggest races of the spring. You know, there was no coverage for me to watch. I wanted to watch it.
Show your true colours tonight. I suddenly
feel absolutely terrible. And I shall be taking out a subscription to tonight. But yeah, cycling has got a lot of work to do in terms of making itself more appealing to television viewers. Now, personally, I'm probably unusual in that I will sit down and watch the Tour of Flanders from, if I'm not there, I'll watch it from the minute it comes on Eurosport to the end. You know, Paris-Roubaix the same, the big race is the same. If I wasn't at the Tour de France, I would dedicate a lot of time to watching as much of the live coverage as I can. But I accept that the as a percentage of people who will watch sport, not everyone is going to dedicate that amount of time to watching cycling. And so it's inherently quite a difficult thing to broadcast anyway. It's difficult to tell people what the story is going to be. Even in a cricket match, which plays out over a similar sort of amount of time, you kind of know what everyone is building towards. And I know, obviously, everyone's building towards the finish line and who's going to win the race, but the narrative unfolds sometimes far too predictably, sometimes very unpredictably, and it's difficult sometimes to put into context what is shown on the screen until you know the result at the end. And so I think cycling has a big hurdle to overcome in terms of how it presents itself to a more casual viewer. And I think a lot of the technological things that they could do but don't, you know, they need to look at fairly urgently. I mean, they tried cameras in team cars at the Tour of Flanders a few years ago, and that from our point of view, that was brilliant because the package that the Belgian TV company put together was hilarious, and it made a few people look a bit stupid, which is why they didn't repeat the experiment. I mean, Jonathan Waters sat there in the Garmin car. Was it their car that crashed into the back of somebody else? And, you know, it was sort of like Keystone Cops, but it was great entertainment in terms of sort of whether you can get heart rates on the screen, whether you can get, you know, graphics that actually show how fast the brake is moving, how fast the bunch is moving. You know, these things could be achieved, but there doesn't seem to be at the moment the will to go into those areas, partly because you know, at the moment the audience perhaps isn't big enough in the growth countries, and in the traditional countries they're happy with what they've got.
I mean, on that, one of the earlier podcasts we did at the start of the year was with David Miller, and there's a film being made of him this year by Finlay Pretzel, who took part in that podcast as well. And they're off to Tirreno Adriatico next week to film. And they have been given the green light by the UCI to do some quite experimental things with their cameras in terms of where they place them and have more. I knew as I was saying that it was going to sound wrong. But yeah, they're going to have various motorbikes and they're going to have, I think, possibly bike-mounted cameras and things like that. Don't know if I'm supposed to say that, but they're doing that.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Any other questions?
It follows on in some ways, because I think cycling is a sport that is the quality of the writing makes a lot of difference to it, because it takes a long time to watch on television, but when that story is condensed in print, it has a life of its own vivacity. And one of the things that happens is there seems a lot of interaction between the journalists and the riders. Now, in most other sports, they, as time goes on, they become more controlling and more paranoid. Do you see this happening in cycling, and is that a threat to its dissemination?
So the question is that cycling lends itself to good writing because it takes place over such a long time. I think also we don't see a lot. Perhaps for these reasons, it's difficult to broadcast what goes on inside the peloton. And another reason for the good writing is the relationships the writers have with the riders. There's a far more accessibility than perhaps in other sports. Is that changing?
I think it is quite quickly. It feels as though it's accelerated just perhaps in the last couple of years. I mean, Team Sky, for example, famously, I think it was 2010 when they started, experimented, didn't they, with kind of screens around the team bus, so, you know, that journalists and fans couldn't really see what was going on. I mean, that's part of the appeal, to be able to walk around the buses and see what's going on and get relatively up close and personal. But, I mean, buses in themselves as well have made it difficult from a journalist's point of view, that riders often just hide on these buses and then at the last minute pop out and head to the start. So, you know, you're standing there waiting for a long time sometimes to try and grab an interview or a quote with someone, and yeah, you can waste a lot of time just waiting. And PR people and officers as well, in teams as well, have made the process slower. That it really was only a few years ago, really, that you could ring a rider up directly for an interview. You still can to an extent, to some of them, if you've maybe got a better relationship with them or you've done an interview with them and you know, you maybe get their direct number, but it is harder. And I mean, it's still nowhere near the likes of football, where if you are granted an interview, you often have to, you know, quote that it was in through Gillette or whatever, you know, a sponsor has to be named. So I think cycling probably is still the you know, very accessible sport for the media and for fans. But it definitely is going in the wrong direction.
Although I think we're still very lucky as journalists in cycling. You know, we do still have the access that we have at races, even at the Tour de France. You know, as the riders right up to the start, you can often grab them for a word, you couldn't stand in the players' tunnel at Arsenal or something and grab players as they walked onto the pitch, and that's effectively what we do. And at the smaller races, it's even easier. So I think we're still, you know, you've been to the Middle East, Tour of Qatar, we all stay in the same hotel at these races, and you know, you can sit down with a rider in the evening and interview them. It's maybe changed a bit, but it's still a world away from a lot of other big money sports.
Yeah, I think those early season races and training camps as well, I think often the team is maybe, I don't know, you know, a bit kinder almost to the media, and like sort of here's your chance to get your interviews, and you know, knowing that you won't perhaps bother them as much later on.
I mean, we're also lucky. A lot of the riders are, not all of them, but a lot of them are eloquent, and they do have great stories, and a lot of them are quite happy to share those stories. And it helps, you know, if somebody is a domestique or does a particular job that perhaps isn't visible to people, sometimes they can be quite happy to get that story out there.
You're right, providing you can get to them, which you still can often, then they're happy to talk to you. But sometimes you're sort of, it's the PR officers who are sort of saying, "Oh, wait a minute, you need to come through me." And you know, I guess that's where the barrier is.
Just on the point about the sort of the storytelling, I suppose, when I first got interested in cycling, there wasn't the wealth of stuff to read on the internet that there wasn't the internet, so you had to wait until Cycling Weekly came out on a Thursday, and then you would read an account of the race. And then over the years, as sort of more stuff, more footage has kind of turned up on YouTube, and I've talked to, particularly in the process of doing Sean Kelly's autobiography, asking him about races based on source material from magazines written 30 odd years ago, you realise that, you know, one account of a race from a journalist or one account of a race from a rider, you know, there's 200 riders in a race, there's 200 stories to be told. And I think one of the things that certain writers in the anthology have done really well is pick out some stories that perhaps are already quite familiar, but look at them from a completely different angle, often years later, and add a kind of fresh understanding to something that we think we know a lot about.
I think we've probably got time for another two questions. So one there, the question was, David Miller said in our earlier podcast that there's no longer a patron, a boss, and there isn't the same respect from the younger riders towards the older riders. I suspect that older riders have said this throughout history. I think they always say this, yeah. Don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I can remember when David Miller was one of those riders who didn't have any respect for anyone who was 10 years older than him. So I think, you know, it's just a natural order of things, isn't it?
I mean, there's even if they just see themselves as patrons, there's guys like Cancellara who can act like the union leader at times. There are riders, I think, who are respected and perhaps...
Yeah, and I think from our point of view, there are few things more exciting in sport than seeing a kind of young tyro come and upset the established order. And you know, when Sagan was doing his, you know, his goofy victory celebrations a couple of years, and Cancellara started getting the hump, I thought that was, you know, that was pretty good. That was pretty entertaining. And Cancellara, I think, splits opinion, because I think some people think that he's overstepped the mark with, you know, he almost has tried to take on that old patron role, so much so that some of the riders now refer to him as Chief Commissaire Cancellara.
We look back on previous patrons with a certain romanticism, perhaps, as well. You know, Bernardino being the best example, I think. And I'm sure at the time he wasn't at the time universally popular, certainly among the other riders and the press as well, because he could nullify races. You know, there was I've just finished a book where I've gone into old Stage of the Tour, and there was one, some of you may remember, Joe Pellier, who won a stage in 1989. He'd made his name a few years earlier at the Tour, in his first Tour that he rode, when he attacked on a day that Bernard Hinault had decided was going to be an easy day, and the message didn't get through to him, and he attacked, and Hinault chased after him and said, you will never win a bike race. And we look back on that now, and it's one of the great stories of the Tour, but really, at the time, that was a terrible way to behave, and he did nullify that particular stage of the race. And I'm sure, you know, as much as Cancellara is unpopular among some riders, you know, at the time would have been unpopular, even if they'd have been scared to tell him that. So, do we have time for a final question?
Dan's touched on it a little bit, but with proper stage races coming back, what do you think is kind of most depressing or damaging? Is it teams racing to power data, or is it armchair power data analysis on the internet?
Okay, cracking question. With the stage races about to start again, because it is restricted to stage races, this phenomenon, is it, what's more depressing, dispiriting? Is it teams racing to power data, or is it the armchair experts attempting to analyse the power data and deduce from that whether somebody is doping or not? Lionel.
Well, I find elements of both quite tedious. I mean, I don't particularly, you know, there's an awful lot to admire about the way Bradley Wiggins won the Tour and the way Chris Froome won the Tour. They're completely different to one another. I try to divorce the fact that Bradley Wiggins is British from how I feel about that 2012 victory and think, if he was a German or a Spaniard or an Italian, how would we have felt going around France for 2 weeks or watching on TV for 2 weeks, pretty much knowing the outcome of the race from the first mountain stage onwards? And really, the comparisons go back to sort of Indurain, who did exactly that, Armstrong, who did exactly that. And I have to concede, I would feel about Wiggins the same way I felt about Indurain and Armstrong, which was that they made the Tour de France predictable, and I am a fan of unpredictability. So I like the fact that there's a sort of loose cannon, a kind of a firework that can go off someone like Quintana. They bring the race alive for me. When it comes to the analysis of the climbing performances and this kind of performance-based suspicion that we have now, and it will kick off again as soon as the riders start climbing the familiar climbs, is that the variables are so great, it seems to me, and the prickliness of the scientists who are putting forward their analysis is so great that I just have no faith in their findings. They can't know. There's so much about a stage or a mountain and a rider that they cannot know. Where, you know, have they weighed the rider that morning? Have they weighed the bike? Do they know, you know, on a 14-kilometer climb, if you choose one line round each corner or another line round each corner, is it still 14 kilometers or is it 14.1 kilometers? How much does that throw out? And there's no, the sort of the familiar scientists who are putting forward this data and saying that this performance must mean, you know, this means this performance is questionable because I've estimated this. When challenged about their data, they behave very unscientifically. Scientists like to put forward their findings and then allow their peers to kind of you know, review it. And we don't really see that in cycling. And I think if we're going to go down that route, then it would be good if we were able to do it in a far more scientific way. And then it becomes credible and perhaps means something.
I don't want the Tour de France to be about riders being timed on climbs. I find that it goes against everything that I love about the Tour de France in particular. And I don't think we know enough to know that a certain performance, if the figures are accurate, that a certain performance equals doping. I don't think we know enough about how the human body works, what it's capable of. I mean, the example of, I may have mentioned this already on a previous podcast, but I had this discussion with a guy at an event in Glasgow where it was a great Graham O'Bree event, and he was talking, you know, Graham O'Bree set the hour record in 93. There's no doubt at all that if Graham O'Bree did a performance like that now, people would definitely think he was doping. I mean, I don't think he was doping, but the fact is he broke a record that had been set by a rider who was blood doping 9 years earlier at altitude, and Francesco Moser was one of the greats. And here's a little-known Scottish amateur who did break the hour record. You know, he's fortunate that he did it at that time, and it was hailed as a great athletic achievement, which I believe it was. But had he done that now, there's no question at all that people would be deeply, deeply suspicious.
I mean, we've talked about, just in terms of the threshold, this imaginary threshold above which someone must be doping. I mean, we've talked about how fallible some of the calculations are and how many other variables there are, you know, technology, etc. I mean, one thing that I think also gets ignored is if you just think of how big and how diverse the talent pool is now in professional cycling to what it was 15 years ago. You know, I talked earlier about how cycling was a working class sport in Italy, and it was in France, and it was in Spain. Basically, every single professional cyclist was white Caucasian from a working class background in four countries. Now, I mean, it's still not diverse. You know, they still are predominantly white Caucasian, but middle class kids from Kazakhstan, from America, from Belgium. You know, it's the standards should have risen exponentially, disproportionately, because the talent pool is so much bigger and so much more diverse.
And I was just going to add, I think sort of for every cynic, I think there's, you know, another person who's thoroughly enjoyed watching the performance. And I mean, yeah, these, you know, cynical people tend to be the ones who are quite vociferous on Twitter or the internet. And I mean, the national aspect that Lionel brought up there, I mean, a lot of people would have thoroughly enjoyed watching Wiggins and Froome dominate, you know, and at last for the Brits to be doing well. And yet, on the other hand, like Lionel said, if it had been a Spaniard or an Italian dominating it in that fashion, then yeah, those same people might have sort of found it really boring or indeed asked questions of them.
I think, you know, the Lella said cynical. I think it, as journalists and everybody who loves the sport has got to be sceptical because of the recent history. But I think there are grounds for scepticism in some cases, and in some cases there aren't. I personally, I'm not somebody who's going to base my scepticism on estimates of power data. Can we have one final question? One final question, because that was a bit of a downer, that one. Right at the back. Women's road cycling. In the track cycling context, there is sort of parity there because it doesn't have the history and tradition, I think. And so in road cycling, there is the Women's Tour of Britain this year. There's definitely progress being made. You know, I think that someone like Marianne Vos is a very marketable star. And Laura Trott in this country, Lizzie Armitstead, and those people are very important, but the races are very important as well. But it does, you know, there has been talk of a women's Tour de France, and I think that a women's Tour of Britain is better. It's a new event in a new place, and a chance for an event to become the sort of premier event for women without piggybacking on an established men's event. I think it almost has to develop as almost like a different sport in a way.
Yeah, I think sport, whether it's male sport or female sport, needs stories, it needs characters, it needs rivalries. And I think the women's tour that's going to be happening in early May, you know, has the perfect platform to create some of those stories. I mean, Marianne Vos is, you know, pound for pound, probably up there with Peter Sagan as the best sort of all-round cyclist in the world. She can do absolutely everything, cyclocross, track, time trialing, road, stage racing. So, you know, this is an opportunity, if they market it correctly, if they get a bit of TV coverage, you know, to tell people that this is the very best in the world coming to compete here. And that will slowly capture the imagination. It may not happen immediately, but I think there has been more of a willingness, certainly for, you know, the newspapers that cover track cycling. They don't discriminate between, you know, men and women. They want winners. And so the last week's track world championships with Joe Rousell, particularly Laura Trott getting a medal as well, you know, they're stories that newspapers and magazines will want to tell, and people will want to read about. And I think the more platform there are for those stories to be told, the more the level of the profile can come up.
I think 2014 is going to be a real sort of crunch year for women's cycling. I mean, it's fantastic that it's the organisers of the Tour of Britain who are doing this women's tour in May, and the field they've got is amazing. They've got anyone coming, really. But we keep name dropping, don't we? It's terrible. But I was speaking to Katie Colclough the other day for this book I'm doing, who's the team time trial world champion. She won it with the Specialized Lululemon team last year, the end of last year, and that was her final race. She retired, and I still didn't really understand why she'd retired. And I spoke to her about this, and I wanted her to sort of say how terrible, you know, women's cycling was. I expected that her answer to be that, you know, you can't make money and it's, you know, doesn't get any coverage. But her answer was quite sort of, yeah, not what I expected. She was actually sort of just saying, well, actually, I found it difficult being away from home all the time. And, you know, she didn't really like that it was going in a sort of more corporate direction, which weirdly is a good thing. I think it is sort of perhaps catching up with men's cycling. So yeah, I think this year could be really key. And I know a lot of people are pushing for a full women's Tour de France, and it is only a one-day race on the final day, but nevertheless I think we've sort of moved on quite a long way this year.
Yep. So Daniel, have you anything to add to that?
Not really, just more TV coverage, just however it can get it. It just desperately needs more TV coverage, I think.
Thank you very much, everybody, for coming along. I think there will be opportunities to buy the cycling anthology back here. We've got to ask Frank, which was our top question?
I think we'll give it to the man in the hat.
The man in the hat? I hope I didn't influence that. It was a good question. So, future Team Sky director Sporty, for the question about the race radios. Well done. Got your tickets here. It's track racing, I'm afraid. Thank you, everybody, for coming along. Great turnout. Hope this is the first of many events that we'll do here. Frank?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great, thank you. See you next week. I'm Richard Moore. Thank you, Daniel Freeb.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel Burney.
Thank you.
And thank you, Alice Bacon.
Thank you very much.
Cycling podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship, and design.